Community Radio.
It's about real people.
Not sound bites.
Not more talking heads.
Not on this show.
Interchange is a community access media forum fostering unfiltered open dialogue on the people, issues, and events impacting life in South Central Indiana and beyond.
Conversations that challenge the ways we perceive the world around us.
Real people.
Real issues.
This is your forum.
This is Interchange.
Good evening and welcome to Interchange. My name is Ashley Beeman. Tonight we talk about food. Professor Nick Colather chats with Susan Hu about his compelling book, The Hungry World, a book about hunger and the cold world, and U.S. government policies to solve hunger in Asia post-World War II. Also, food educator Kat Gulick talks with William Morris about how her attitudes about food changed her life, and now she works to help others help themselves. She shares her knowledge with Interchange, including some in-studio food preparation. Our first interview is with Professor Nick Colather.
Welcome to Interchange. My name is Susan Hu. Today, we have historian, associated professor from IU, Professor Nick Colather, here to talk about his new book, The Hungry World. Welcome to Interchange, Professor Colather.
Thank you, Susan. I'm happy to be here.
In your book, you wrote about U.S. and the hunger problem of the world.
That's right. It's about the United States and its attempts to address the global problem of hunger around the world.
This title is really catching, The Hungry World. Why did you pick this?
It's a phrase from Lyndon Johnson. He often referred to the hungry world as the world that the United States wanted to help. And he talked about escalating a war on hunger around the world with the United States as the leader. It was a way for him to add some moral urgency to his global campaign for nation building and a foreign policy that was really tarnished by Vietnam. But his hunger relief efforts were a way to kind of redeem American foreign policy.
Yeah, usually when we think about foreign policy, we won't think about food. When was the first time the United States see there is a food problem?
Well, they didn't think there was a global food problem for a very long time. During the 19th century, for instance, the idea that hunger and scarcity were part of the human condition, that people were naturally hungry around the world, and that famine was endemic in certain parts of the world, Asia in particular. In the 1880s, the former president, Ulysses S. Grant, visited China in the midst of a terrible famine in which millions of people died. And he saw nothing unusual about this. He saw it as something that was probably very common in China. And his only advice to the Chinese ministers was that they should build a few railroads. He thought that would help. So for a long time, it wasn't considered to be a major problem. But then the invention of the calorie as a unit of measure, I argue, really created an opening for people to begin to believe that food was a single thing and that the United States could manage it around the world. I mean, think about it. Before the calorie, there really wasn't an idea that rice and wheat were the same thing, that beer and chicken or vegetables and corned beef might actually all be part of the same thing. There were certainly government policies about agriculture and about wheat and for fisheries and various other food items, but they were very particular to those foods. There wasn't a general category of policy about food in general. But what the calorie did, once it was invented, and it was invented at a very specific time by an American in 1896, and it created a notion that all food was essentially the same. That the only differences between what Americans ate and what, say, the Chinese ate was the amount, not different kinds. And that was revolutionary because it was formerly thought that food and diet and cuisines were racially distinct. In other words, the Japanese ate what they ate because Japanese had different biological needs from, say, Swiss people or Scottish people. And what the calorie proved was that, no, all food is essentially the same.
And we can measure them.
And we can measure it. And that meant that there was such a thing as a global food supply. There was a total amount One could imagine now a total amount of food for the world. And one could think now, for the first time, about whether certain areas had surpluses or shortages of food. And one could measure that as well. And once they began to make those measurements, they discovered that indeed in Asia, people ate substantially less as measured in calories than people did in the United States, that Americans had the most calorie-dense diet in the world. And they began to think about the possibility of the rest of the countries of the world having a diet like the United States. And so it made the United States feel like they could lead the way in this. And very quickly, World War I came along, and the calorie proved to be an invaluable tool in managing just that kind of transition. Across Europe, because of the war, there were famines and starvation was breaking out. The United States needed a way, independent of the markets, to gather food in the United States, to decide how much was extra, and take that food over to Europe and give it to Europeans. And not only that, but to give them just the right amount so that they could remain healthy and productive. The calorie gave them a tool for being able to do that. Herbert Hoover was the engineer of these projects.
And there was a project.
Yes, called the American Recovery Administration, the American Relief Administration, sorry. And Herbert Hoover, later president of the United States, was the head of it. And he used American food effectively throughout Europe, not just to suppress famine, but also to suppress revolution. He saw food as a tool that the United States could use to manipulate European governments. And he used the calorie as a way in which to determine how much food was needed in various places, how much to send to different ports, and how much even to give to different people.
Yeah, that must be very revolutionary at that time.
It really changed the way Americans thought about global problems. They formerly thought of problems of war and peace as a matter of alliances and military structures and defenses. And now they began to think about what they called the underlying sources of war.
Underlying sources.
That's right. And they began to think that wars may begin because people don't have enough of certain things. They don't have enough freedom. They don't receive enough wages. Their factories are short of raw materials. Or they don't have enough food.
Yeah, really close to us.
So in this way, foreign policy began to spread from concerns related to treaties and defenses and things like that and alliances into the most intimate parts of human experience, into things like work and reproduction and even diet.
And is that when and why American leaders consider hunger and food so important? Was it from that time?
Absolutely. And they began to, it wasn't just American leaders too. The calorie really gave a tool for other countries to begin to think seriously about their diets as an instrument of statecraft. The Japanese were probably among the ones who seized on it most readily. They improved on the devices that the United States developed to measure calories, even creating a calorimeter that would measure food intake and work output on individual people, a kind of a gas mask type device that they put on teachers and workers to determine what amounts of food different occupations needed. And from that, they began to create what we now call the Japanese diet. What we think of as Japanese food was really created by the Japanese Navy in the 1920s. As an attempt to raise Japanese dietary standards to what they called a European level.
Is that different from before?
Very different from before. The main difference was the addition of beef and flour, wheat flour.
Beef and wheat flour.
Wheat flour. And you couldn't think of Japanese food now without Kobe beef, the famous Kobe beef,
yeah.
And tempura,
all
of which, you know, really didn't exist in Japan before that.
Before 1920.
Yes. And not only that, but it also standardized the diet across the country. There was no Japanese diet before. There was a diet in Honshu, and then there was another diet, and there was another cuisine in Tokyo, and different regions of Japan had different regional cuisines. But through these efforts, the national government intervened in individual people's diets and tried to raise their standard of dietary intake.
That's really interesting.
To make their soldiers stronger, to make their workers more efficient.
And so where did the scientists first try to address this problem?
Well, the group of scientists in the United States that was most interested in this was associated with the Rockefeller Foundation, which was a big private foundation funded by John D. Rockefeller, the oil magnate, which in the 1920s was really looking for a mission and really seized upon the kind of Wilsonian goals that Hoover had first articulated during World War I. And the idea that wars could be prevented through addressing underlying problems. And they began tackling things like disease, unemployment, standards of living, and standards of diet. And they began developing scientific techniques, what they called a science of man, in order to address these problems. And in the 1930s, the Rockefeller Foundation really began to look at plant breeding and wheat and corn as things that they could intervene in and create new scientific techniques that could be spread around the world. And the place where they really applied this first was in Mexico. And they did it in Mexico because the Rockefeller Foundation's programs around the world were being rolled up by the war. They were heavily involved in France and the Louis Pasteur Institutes there. They were heavily involved in China and the Peking Union medical colleges that they had created. But all of those were overtaken by Japanese or German armies during World War II. And so they were pushed out of regions around the world. But still, they were thinking ahead, and they were thinking that the war would end. And when it did, they wanted the Rockefeller Foundation to be able to develop some new techniques that they could begin to spread around the world. And so what we know is the Green Revolution really began in Mexico in 1939. Mexico. The Rockefeller Foundation sent a group of scientists down to Mexico in an attempt to develop a new science of agriculture.
And can you tell us a little bit more about Green Revolution?
Yeah, that phrase was actually invented in 1968. And the Green Revolution is generally considered to be, after the Marshall Plan, the biggest success story in American foreign aid history. It was a series of techniques that were spread by American aid programs and by American technicians and scientists that used a combination of plant breeding and chemicals in order to dramatically raise the production of two staple crops, rice and wheat. And really, the technique involved breeding the plant for the fertilizer. Formerly, plants had been bred for taste, for size, for beauty, for appearance. They were bred for the market, in other words, what customers wanted a grain of rice to look like and taste like. But the Rockefeller Foundation came up with the idea, let's breed plants that have the biggest response to chemical fertilizer. And consequently, they came up with revolutionary new dwarf strains of wheat and rice, which looked radically different from the way wheat and rice had formerly looked. Rice was formerly a tall, light green, willowy plant that stood in fields and paddies. And the dwarf wheat is a low, bush-like plant that's about a quarter the size of a quarter the height of a standard rice plant. And similarly, the wheat plants were short and stubby, with short straws, but which had enormous heads on them filled with wheat grains. So more of the production of the plant went into the grain and less into the stalk.
And that was the beginning of the Grain Revolution.
That's right. It was only later, in the 1960s, that they took these techniques from Mexico and moved them to India and Pakistan and began using them to address the hunger problem there.
How did that go?
Well, the impetus for that was a Cold War concern about what was happening in South Asia as a consequence of the Chinese Revolution. There was a real fear that India would be the next big country in Asia to fall to communism. Vietnam, in many ways, was a holding action in Southeast Asia in order to prevent what were seen as a number of dominoes in South Asia from falling. But the biggest domino was India. And they were very fearful that India, because of its internal problems, because of its weak central government, would lose control over the country. And there were reasons to think this. In 1962, in Kerala, the first government outside of Europe to elect a communist administration came into power in one Indian state. So there was a strong communist party, and there were strong separatist movements throughout India that might have thrown the country into chaos. So the Green Revolution was really a strategy. It was a Cold War strategy used to solidify the central government, to address the underlying problem of hunger, but mainly to prevent the kind of insurgency and civil war that was already underway in Vietnam. So it was a political tool, this food aid technique, this agricultural technique was a political tool, just like napalm or the helicopter, designed to prevent counterinsurgencies. And that's been a characteristic of American food policy mm-hmm. throughout. The United States doesn't address the hunger problem out of humanitarian concern or because it's interested in solving the food problem, but it's interested in hunger as a way to get at other political problems.
Yeah, as a political tool.
That's right, as a political tool.
You mentioned the Chinese Revolution earlier. What's the influence of that?
It was huge. The Chinese Revolution took the Truman administration by surprise. It was thought that China would go through a prolonged period of chaos, but that no government would be able to consolidate control over it. So when Mao's armies took control of all of China by 1949, it took the Americans by surprise. And in analyzing this, they interpreted it as an uprising of the peasants, that rural people throughout China had grown fed up with the nationalist regime, and that the nationalist regime had not so much been defeated in the field by armies as kicked out of the country mm-hmm. by the mass of the peasants. So they began to take a look at the peasant as the key person in Asia, the strategic constituency mm-hmm. that needed to be brought over to the American side. So agriculture became very important. The United States really didn't have good techniques for modernizing Asian agriculture, didn't know how to go about it. But the communists really did have answers for the problems of the peasant. And they saw this as a huge disadvantage for the United States.
And that's when the United States began to pay attention into the Asia food situation.
Absolutely. And the agriculture situation as a whole, not just food, but the condition of the peasant. And somehow winning over the peasant mm-hmm. as an ally of the United States. And many people in the United States saw the peasants as natural allies of the United States. They saw them as individualistic, not inherently communistic, mm-hmm. but people who were upset, and for good reason. They were put upon by landlords. They had no power over the future of their own country. They were experiencing what American modernizers called a revolution in rising expectations. Through the modern mass media, they could see gleaming cities and cars and material mm-hmm. goods that other people had. And they knew they had no power to get those things for themselves, no power to get education or to have a good diet. And consequently, they were demanding those things. And the country or the system that could meet those demands the best would win the Cold War. And so the Americans knew that this was an arena that they had to fight in.
So were alternatives to the Green Revolution ever considered?
There are a few of them that I talk about in my book. The Green Revolution actually came relatively late in the 1960s. Before that, they tried a number of other things. One, as a counter-revolutionary technique, they saw land reform as a key tool. And this was applied in Japan and in Taiwan. Very successfully. They saw landlords as the key oppressive force affecting the peasants. And so the way to win over the peasant was to give the peasant land. Mm-hmm. And they developed techniques that expropriated land, took the land away from landlords, and gave it over to the people who actually tilled it, these so-called land-to-the-tiller programs.
And that turned out to be a huge success Japan and Taiwan?
It was a success in Japan and Taiwan. It wasn't a success, however, in the United States.
Why do you think it didn't?
It was seen as a technique of modernization that was out of sync with the American way. Mm-hmm. The United States doesn't expropriate land from its owners and give it to other people. And there was a great fear articulated in the Chicago Tribune and other newspapers across the United States that these techniques that were being tried out in Taiwan and Japan and South Korea would be brought back to the United States, and that the Truman administration, maybe the Eisenhower administration, would begin to think about taking large ranches and estates away from American owners and give them over to the ranch hands and the farmers who actually tilled the land for efficiency's sake, or in order to appease that constituency. And so it was seen as inherently un-American. And the United States was being communistic in doing this. And the leading figure was a guy named Wolf Ladyshinsky, who under MacArthur had implemented the land reform in Japan. And he was persecuted in a McCarthyite purge. He was investigated for security reasons. He was originally from Russia. He had fled Russia after the communists took over. He still had two sisters there. He was a bachelor.
Mm-hmm.
He was a Jew. He fit into a lot of marginalized categories in the 1950s that made him inherently suspect to anti-communists. And he advocated land reform. And so there was an attempt to take away his security clearance as a way to get him out of the picture, similar to what they did to the father of the atomic bomb, Robert Oppenheimer.
Mm-hmm.
And it was a huge public battle because many people, including powerful people, Senators Humphrey and Judd and other powerful Democrats, saw Wolf Ladyshinsky as the man with the idea that was going to stop communism. He was the most powerful anti-communist out there. It was, according to William Michener, as if Richard Nixon had been accused of communism. And for them, it was crazy to think that this guy was suspect in some way. But nonetheless, there was the other side. And conservatives began to feel, and certain farm interests began to feel, that this was a communistic way to go. And consequently, land reform as a technique was really marginalized, taken off the table in the late 1950s. And it really didn't come back on until the latter, more desperate stages of the Vietnam War. So that was one technique, but there were others too.
We've been talking about the Green Revolution. What do you think we can learn from the history?
Well, if we look at this long, 100-year-long history of American attempts to grapple with the problem of hunger, I think one lesson that one could take away from it is that the food problem as a whole can't be addressed directly by sending food or by encouraging the production of food. Hunger is really a problem of justice. It's often construed, and it always has been construed in American policy, as a problem of scarcity, that there isn't enough food for people. But if one looks at famine zones, even like the one in Somalia today, there's plenty of food in the famine zone. It's that people there don't have the access to that food.
Yeah, I remember in your book you mentioned that in Africa the problem is not there's not enough food, but those are not entitled food to the people.
That's correct. We often think of Africa as a country that is desperately hungry and that needs food, and it receives millions of tons of food aid from the United States every year. But Africa, sub-Saharan Africa, is a major exporter of food. It provides virtually all of the food that's consumed on European tables. There's no French market that would be complete without vegetables or citrus fruits or cut flowers that are all grown in Africa. So the food that's eaten in France and Germany and Spain, much of it comes from sub-Saharan Africa, from often the very zones that are considered to be close to starving. So it's never a problem of not enough food. And this has historically been the case, too. Even during the Irish potato famine, Jonathan Swift writes about seeing the docks where the coffin ships, the ships that took away millions of poor, starving Irish emigrants to the New World, were docked right next to ships that were taking millions of pounds of beef and mutton out of Ireland. So in the midst of a famine, food was leaving Ireland, not being brought in. So it's often the case that that where you have starvation and hunger, you also have huge surpluses of food. And we tend not to address that that issue squarely. We tend to see it as a problem of scarcity. That's one issue. We also tend to focus too much, I think, on the issue of famine, which takes a fair number of lives and requires emergency and often very dramatic kind of rescue operations. But the real problem, the real killer around the world is not famine, it's chronic malnutrition that robs children of nutrients and exposes them to all kinds of diseases and takes millions of lives every year. And chronic malnutrition is generally not seen as an issue that ought to be addressed by international bodies or by U.S. policy.
Why do you think usually we don't pay attention to that?
Because it's less politically salient. People who are merely hungry and not starving are not likely to be revolutionary, or their revolutionary tendencies are less likely to be attributed to their hunger. Whereas famine is seen as a politically explosive condition, something that needs to be addressed for geostrategic reasons and for reasons of self-interest of the United States. And so the humanitarian interest in addressing malnutrition is usually outweighed by the more compelling geostrategic interest in handling crises.
It is more about the political power behind the issue instead of just the agriculture itself.
That's right. It's about creating, using food as a tool to create certain types of trade regimes and certain types of governments. The way in which the United States, for instance, addressed famines in India in the 1960s was specifically calculated in order to shore up the power of Indira Gandhi's central government. It was thought that the state governments, which were prone, as I said, to communist elections, were far too powerful. They had jurisdiction over agricultural matters. And consequently, the emergency of a famine provided a momentary opportunity where the United States could intervene effectively and change the politics of that country. It wasn't just the Johnson administration. A few years later, the Nixon administration, when a famine broke out in Bangladesh, said in all of their private communications that this was a tremendous opportunity for the United States.
Let's go back to the book, The Hungry World. Can you give us a very brief summary of this book? What can we expect to learn from it?
Well, I think one of the things you'll learn from it is is just the long history that the United States has in dealing with these issues, and the way in which we have conceptualized a problem of hunger in a consistent way for a very long period of time. And that way is really a kind of Malthusian approach to hunger, a notion that hunger is directly related to population growth, and that by addressing the problem of scarcity, one can solve the underlying problem of hunger. I think that long record shows that that idea is mistaken, and that food is often used by the United States and by modernizers of various kinds to address political agendas. I don't expect that to change, incidentally. I think that even in Africa today, as we address these problems, they are addressed in a way that's designed to make Africa conform to certain trade regimes and other goals of international organizations and of the United States itself. But it's in many ways a sobering lesson about the ways in which politics affects even the most humanitarian of enterprises.
Those underlying issues like food.
Absolutely.
They were used for political purpose.
Yes, we often don't think about food as something that is of great geopolitical significance. But international politics intrudes into all aspects of human life, even the most intimate. And during the 1960s in particular, those aspects of life, reproduction and food supply and diet, gender relations, were considered to be critical tools in winning the Cold War.
Okay, thank you very much.
I appreciate it, Susan.
I am Susan Hu. Today we've been talking to Professor Nick Callather about his new book, The Hungry World. Thank you very much for coming here today.
It's You're welcome, Interchange. Susan. Thanks for having me.
Support for WFHB comes from Darn Good Soup on the west side of the Courthouse Square. Darn Good Soup is open from 11 a.m. to 7:30 p.m., serving 10 to 12 soups daily plus salads and baked goods. Vegetarian and vegan options abound. Darn Good Soup, it's fast, it's healthy, it's darn good. Online at darngoodsoup.com. And support for WFHB comes from Bloom Magazine, a proud underwriter of community radio. Bloom Magazine is celebrating its 5th anniversary. In the August-September issue of Bloom, look for It's a Wonderful Town, 50 Reasons to Love Bloomington, plus The Girls of Meadowood and the Life and Legacy of T.C. Steele. Bloom Magazine is available at more than 200 businesses in the Bloomington area. More information is available at magbloom.com.
In our second segment, food educator Kat Gulick shares her thoughts about the quality of food and the way it affects the quality of life.
Good afternoon. My name is William Morris, and I have the pleasure this afternoon of talking with Catherine Gulick. Catherine is here to share with us a whole range of information having to do with healthier living, buying, growing, storing, and celebrating food. Catherine, good to have you with us today.
Thank you, William. It's good to be here.
Catherine, you and I have had the opportunity to talk, and I know a little bit of your history about, you know, how you came to be an educator in this wonderful area. Could you share some of that with our audience?
Sure. Well, it's a journey that began a long, long time ago, but really it got kickstarted when my mother became ill. And she was diagnosed with cancer and died shortly after her diagnosis.
How long ago was that?
It's about 10 years ago. Well, actually, 10 years ago next month. And so I was really angry at the time because I saw that my mom wasn't taking personal responsibility for her own health. The doctors weren't wanting to talk about anything outside their own protocol. In other words, anytime I brought up diet or food, I was just, you know, basically asked to not ask the questions anymore, and by my mom as well. So after my mom passed, I continued to seek information that I was seeking for my mother's health, for my own health, and I was sick. I had been had a lot of autoimmune symptoms, didn't know at the time what it was. It turned out to be chronic severe Epstein-Barr, was very overweight, high blood pressure, depressed, stuck in life. And so I found out about a place called the Optimum Health Institute in San Diego, California, nonprofit, and I went through a three-week program and I became trained as a chef. And just started to share my passion of information. It grew from there, but that's the start of it all. And I never seen so many people get well so quick. The stories were enormous and people were diverse, and it didn't matter what was ailing people. It was amazing over a three-week period of time how much health can, how much health you can attain in 3 weeks. It's amazing.
This sounds like it's almost a conversion experience for you.
Conversion experience, transformative.
Well, transformative.
Absolutely, absolutely. Because along with things like the skin getting all glowy, getting energy that I hadn't felt since probably pre-teenager, childhood, also mental clarity. So extremely.
How long did it take for you to sort of notice the change in the symptoms from the Epstein-Barr virus, from the things you were suffering with that? How long did it take before you sort of felt like you were clear of that?
Oh, well, unfortunately, as I began a detoxifying process, I got all the great things like I call the high pro glow and weight loss and energy. Digestive tract was working a lot better. Unfortunately, I was detoxing so fast that autoimmune things were coming up, and at the time I didn't know what it was, so I actually got worse. And that's part of my message now as an educator, the importance of going slow and really introducing a high amount of minerals, vitamins, exercise, and sweating, because I was not doing those things at the time. And so my autoimmune actually got worse from 2002, probably all the way until 2005, and I kept exploring different things. But it wasn't until I came upon a spa place called Hippocrates down in Florida that really pushed the minerals, sea vegetables, the hot-cold treatments, the importance of sweating. Our skin is our largest organ in our body. Therefore, it's really important that we sweat. I think some of these old Russian guys that drink a lot and smoke cigars and live till 100 plus got this one down a long time ago. And when I say hot, cold, too, it's you get your body hot for the first 20 minutes, and then you blast with cold, always scrubbing towards the heart. And then you can go hot, cold, you know, 1 minute at a time. But it's important to heat the body up for 20 minutes first. So anyways, yeah, it wasn't for a good many years. Unfortunately, I really didn't understand what was going on until I fully got the diagnosis, started to understand. And now I embrace my symptoms. They're not entirely gone. It'll be the thing that probably gets me in the end, which takes out some fear in life. Something's going to get us all in the end, right? And so I sort of know my symptoms. But because I know my symptoms, they now give me a flag saying, hey, you just pushed it too far here. And so I'm not a purist. I still take in things that I call poisons. I live in the American culture. I eat with my friends and do things that a lot of people do. And it's just now I have indicators.
Well, I know another thing that happened to you, and I is that you had a child later on in life.
Yes.
And I know that was something you brought up in one of our earlier conversations. Is just that almost as if your child, your daughter,
yeah,
was sort of a great indicator that you were on the right path.
Yeah, absolutely. I wasn't supposed to be able to get pregnant, and I had her at 43. And unfortunately, I did have to have a C-section. I had had some previous surgeries. But other than that, everything was, she was healthy, I was healthy, and it's been an amazing experience. So yeah, I don't think I could have even considered it had I not been down the path of this diet. In fact, in my 30s, I wouldn't even had, even if I could have had a child in my 30s, I didn't have the energy or the mental clarity to be a parent at that time.
Catherine, let's take the next 15 or 20 minutes and see if we can get you to guide us through a short class of how our listeners, myself included, how we can start to think about some of the things that you have done to start to live a healthier life. Can you start at some point here?
Okay. Well, yes. In my class, Super Learning with Superfoods, I tell students, and a lot of times my students are equally my teachers, I do not claim to have all the information. What I've got a great base on is reference knowledge. So I have a couple books that are sort of my Bible. One is A Prescription for Nutritional Healing, which is Diagnosing Yourself. The other is Whole Foods Companion by Diane Onstead, which talks about basically every whole food on the planet. Not every, but close. It's a great reference book. And so I tell students, if they walk away with nothing else, just make sure you juice every day. Green vegetables.
Juice every day.
Juice every day. Feeding the cells directly. No digestion involved, no energy. Boom, you've got your minerals. Boom, you've got, and local produce if possible. Organic if possible. But the second thing I add on is if you can put a smoothie in your diet and add some of the simple blue-green algaes. Chlorella is the highest source of protein on the planet Earth per weight. Very easy to digest again. I always come down to not what are we putting in our body, but how well are we assimilating and how much energy is going in and how alkalizing is the food, because so much of what we eat in our diet is acidic. All the meats, all the cooked foods, all the pastas. So most of us have plenty of the acid and we're needing to get alkaline again and thinking in terms of green. So those two things are my basis for health and finding a way to carry them with you. We talk a lot about a super snack pack. So I today have my giant cooler because we're going to do a couple of juices and smoothies, but normally I have like a little handheld snack pack that I started carrying when I became pregnant. You know, I realized, wow, I really need to nourish myself all day. Wow, well, you have a kid, you really need to nourish yourself and be prepared to nourish your kid all day. Wow, well, that's your role in life, your mother, your teacher. Well, let's just carry this stuff with us and start feeding everybody everywhere we go. Never mind if you do have enough money or not. Like, I really, it's in my belief so much that I've gotten down to zero several times in the recent, I've had financial struggles as everybody else, and I'm blessed. I mean, I will come home and somebody will drop off greens at my house because they know Kat always has a smoothie, always has a juice. So, but those are the real, real basics, the super basics of super learning with superfoods.
Well, I've got a question.
Mm-hmm.
All right, so your smoothie that you have every day, does it change from day to day? You just put different ingredients in your smoothie? Or what would a typical smoothie be like that you would have?
Okay.
I want to write down the ingredients now, and maybe some of our listeners do too.
Okay. All right. Well, I always start with the blue-green algaes. And today we only have spirulina. Ideally, I would have chlorella in there as well.
Our listeners don't know, but you have a couple blenders here in the studio, and you're going to do some mixing right here.
I'm
going to
do some mixing for
you. Okay.
Yes. And I'm actually going to do the smoothie second, but we'll talk about the smoothie first. So you can get these ingredients out and play with this yourself. So let's see. So this one has spirulina in it. It would be ideal to have chlorella. I threw in a medicinal mushroom. There's so many amazing medicinal mushrooms out there, and this one is cordyceps. But that is not always the base, so I want to stay with the base here. I always throw in a package of frozen blueberries, and I put a little honey in for you at home. I don't really do honey so much, but I wanted you to be able to enjoy the taste, the flavor of this. And then I always put in a little dash of cayenne, some turmeric. Turmeric being one of the most anti-inflammatory foods on the planet Earth. And then I take the pulp from my juice and I put it into the smoothie. And you can add all kinds of other things. Sometimes I'll put acidophilus in, probiotics. This is why I like this book, Prescription for Nutritional Healing, is I think about what's going on with my body and I try to throw it in on my smoothie.
It's very interesting because the ingredients that you gave us for your smoothie are not the ingredients that we think of as smoothies from the fast food places or smoothies from other places. This is a serious smoothie.
This is a serious smoothie. And I throw in a little cinnamon and a little nutmeg and a little cayenne for kick. It's a serious smoothie, but I have a class, Super Learning with Superfoods for Kids, and I can get them to drink this stuff. And it's amazing because you put in enough honey and anything, and I can turn it blue, which then becomes a lot more palatable to some people than when it's green because the blueberries make it pretty.
Wow. So are we getting ready to mix it up now?
Yep. Yep. So we're starting with the juice because we're going to take the pulp and put it into the smoothie. So in this juice, I have purslane, which is a weed that grows in most all of our yards. I have sorrel, which is another weed that's grown in our yards, kale, and a little bit of ginseng, which is incredible tonic and adaptogenic herb. We're going to flip this on really quick. And the great thing about using a blender is you don't have to own a juicer. You can just go buy a $5 paint strainer from any local hardware store, and a bowl and a blender will suit you just fine. Now I did put a whole root of ginseng in, which is a little bit harder for a normal blender. I do have a Vitamix that goes 210 miles an hour, but you can soak the ginseng and make it softer. So William, are you ready?
I am ready.
Okay.
We are mixing it up on Interchange.
All right, go for it.
Thank you,
I hear
sister.
You may
Thank
need
you.
That this today. So then this is a
Whoa. Pretty good.
So what I want to know, William, is how you feel as you try to drink most of that. This is a new taste. You're a brave one for going there.
Well, it's not as sweet as maybe I'm used to with my American taste buds, but it is tasty. It's pretty good.
Yeah, and that has no sweetener in it. So you're just drinking straight up green juice with a little bit of water and ginseng. Now here comes the sweet one. We put the pulp into the blender now, and the ingredients we talked about previously. All right.
We have another glass coming. Mm-hmm. And this is the smoothie.
Yes.
Wow. Wow. That's got a little zing to it, too.
Yeah. That's the ginseng.
Yeah.
And, well, there's cayenne, you know, like I said. Now, this I'm not making on the air, but I have a pumpkin seed milkshake.
And that's what I have in my hand now.
Yes. That's raw chocolate, pumpkin seed, some raw honey. And a little bit of chai tea and some coconut.
Wow, that's incredible. Tell me again, what's in this?
Okay, so this is soaked sprouted pumpkin seeds and some water, a little bit of honey, some raw chocolate powder, cacao powder, and a little bit of the same spices, a little nutmeg, cinnamon, and cayenne.
Now, I can imagine, I guess, some of the health benefits of this shake that you gave me just now. Explain some of the health benefits of this.
Well, pumpkin seeds are incredible. First of all, they can be grown local, so I love anytime something can be grown local.
And I think pumpkin seeds are good for prostate.
Prostate, the zinc, high in zinc, protein, easy to assimilate. Again, when you soak a seed, it releases the enzyme inhibitors, so it makes it a little more digestible. So those have been soaked. It's just a really simple, tasty way to get a lot of protein in our diet. Nothing's processed. It's all just fresh and easy to assimilate.
It's interesting that you can get so many of these ingredients in your backyard. You said weeds, or seemingly weeds, that grow in your backyard. Tell us about some of those again.
Ah, seeds and weeds. Well, I'm still learning so much. But the dandelion came from Europe as a medicinal. It's great for the liver. So all these things that people are spraying chemicals on can be feeding us. And what
do you eat dandelion a lot? Do you use it a lot in your in your foods?
I do. As well as lately, I've been putting a lot of lamb's quarter. I didn't have any lamb's quarter left for you today, but that's really rich in iron and nettle. Nettle, stinging nettle, you know, the things that sting you when you walk by in the forest, those are incredible for you. Again, higher in iron also.
You offer these all of this information and this knowledge that you're sharing with us today. I know you give classes.
Uh-huh.
And I believe you give classes through Spirit Tree Farm. Is that
uh-huh.
what it's called?
Uh-huh.
You want to tell us a little bit about that?
Yeah. Well, Spirit Tree Farm is an LLC, and I'm the founder of it. And we offer education as well as marketing. But right now, the focus is really on education and primarily the course Super Learning with Superfoods. And we have a second course called Tribal Living with Ancient Healing, where still Super Learning with Superfoods is the base. The green food diet. And also, I didn't explain that it is a 3-week diet, where the first week is about introducing superfoods and getting highly mineralized. The second week is about going all live, all raw, non-cooked, and mostly non-sugar. And the third week is leading up to a wonderful juice fast.
And this reflects the education, the classes that you took in San Diego. Is that right? This 3-week cycle?
Yeah, somewhat. It's my own spin on things. But I think that's the message that a lot of places like the Optimum Health Institute are trying to get across, is introduce this diet and get yourself a little less addicted to foods that maybe are non-nutritive, not offering us a lot, that are just highly addictive, and then getting to a place where you feel like you're ready to juice.
So let's reiterate that. So the first week would be about what?
The first week would be just putting loads and loads of highly fresh, alkalizing, plant-based diet and a lot of juices and smoothies.
The second week?
The second week, eliminating all cooked foods, all processed foods from your diet, continuing with putting high amounts of mineralized foods and juices and smoothies.
And the third week?
A juice fast if you're ready. If not, we encourage people to try a juice/smoothie fast.
Can people, should people anticipate a sort of a dramatic response from your body as they go into this 3 weeks?
Absolutely. And the thing I like about taking it kind of slow and saying, like, the first week, don't give up anything that you're not wanting to give up, is so that you don't go through any hard emotional. It's kind of a slow process. You just start feeling better. Some people have, like, a slight detoxifying effect, like maybe they go into the bathroom a little more, all the fiber in the smoothies especially. And I think it's pretty minimal in the first week. The second week is when the emotional comes in, because eating cooked foods is a huge familiar part of our culture.
A lifetime practice.
A lifetime practice. And but what's nice is when you get super mineralized in the first week, you really do start to lean towards and want something like that little piece of purslane that you munched on can become something explosive in the mouth. Like, you start to hear and open up to the fact that we have a taste bud called bitter. In our culture, we really don't even explore the bitter part of our taste buds. So it opens up. And the third week, generally speaking, on juice fast, when people are ready, it's just an up and down and a wave. And, you know, to be able to slow down mentally, physically, spiritually, go inward, take time to retreat. But for the most part, I've had such wild amounts of energy, I have to stop doing things like running in the woods. I mean, I have to have people remind me, you feel great, but it's a time to slow down a little bit and do gentler exercises rather than running, because the energies just can be incredible. It's not about starvation. I mean, this is an incredible amount of nutrients you can get in just by juicing. It's amazing.
And and for me, I'm reminded through conversations with people in my family and people that I know that how often the diet that we have become acclimated to in America really just tires us out.
Yes.
And when you talk about a diet that can give us energy, It's an incredible change of mindset.
It's incredible to the point that I warn people a lot of times, you need to know what you want to do with this energy, because you're going to have a lot of it. And so typically what happens at a lot of these retreat places you'll see is people's lower chakras will open up and they'll just call their husband and wife, relationship over, I've met somebody new, I'm feeling great, woo, I'm dancing with the stars. You know, so being prepared for that kind of transformation and going, well, you know, finding some really healthy outlets and other healthy people. And this is why we encourage this workshop. We want to take it into more businesses and churches where there's camaraderie and people, you know, talking about and experiencing this together. Because it's a shift that you can't know unless you try. And the shift I like to explain for a lot of people is a remembrance of what it's like to be under the age of 10 or 5, having all the cells in your body vibrating again, the mitochondria firing up. That's why newborn babies are so sensitive and springy and bouncy and electricity.
One last thought that occurs to me is after people go through this 3 week process of sort of regenerating themselves and regenerating their diet and changing these habits, it seems like they would need some kind of support system after that to keep them going. Does Spiritually Farm or the system that you have, does it offer support beyond the 3 weeks, three months, 6 months, 9 months, mm-hmm. To keep people going?
It does. One, there's an opportunity to apprentice with Spiritually Farm, so you too can become a facilitator as we grow. We also host a lot of weekly and monthly, mostly monthly, raw potlucks. So a big group of people trying to eat this way in all throughout Indiana. And yeah, that's a great place to start right there is the apprenticeship, and the potlucks are amazing.
And you all have some retreats too, don't you? Of some sort?
Yeah. Yeah. Well, the Tribal Living with Ancient Healing, we have a couple events coming up. You can check on the calendar, but also we're available to go into people's homes. So this is kid-friendly, wheat-free, dairy-free. We offer a lot of support for children and adults, classes that are just for adults in the evening as well, like adults in infinity yoga. how to breathe with your partner and talk with your partner, all the way things from how to neti pot, how to sit up straight, just how to be a better person. A lot of these are just really ancient healing techniques. So we're available to come in for a whole weekend or a week long experience. We can help write it together. But there's right now there's five of us that are available, and you can read more about that on the website, www.spirittreefarm.com.
Catherine, it's been nice having you with us today. It's been really great. Thank you so much.
Thank you, William. I enjoyed it.
In our last minute, William Morris offers a few thoughts about globalization.
Tonight on the last minute, I want to share a story about globalization. By way of background, let me say a little bit about myself. I've had a few international and global experiences in my life. I've lived and worked in three countries for a total of 6 years. I spent a few years working with the Agency for International Development in Washington, D.C., and I've taught students from all over the world. But yesterday I had a new experience. I was trying to order cable TV from my home, and all I wanted to do was change the installation date. Well, first of all, I was on hold for nearly 2 hours, but that's a whole nother thing. During this time, however, I spoke to four people. Now, it's become a routine of mine in recent years to ask customer service people, where are they working from? Where are they located? Well, the first on my cable TV installation call, she was from Atlanta, not too far away. But she couldn't help me, and she referred me to another department. The second person was in California, a little further away. She was a very nice woman, but she couldn't help me either. She transferred me to a third person. He was in India. We chatted about the weather in Bombay, but he couldn't help me either. He told me he had to transfer me to another department. This fourth person was in the Philippines. I couldn't believe it. Now, for some reason, this person didn't want to divulge his location. I'm at an offshore location, he told me in a sort of an unusual manner. I asked him, you sound like you're keeping a secret. Why the secrecy? And he was quiet for a moment, and then he spilled the beans. I'm in Manila, he blurted out. Well, in the end, he couldn't help me either. This 2-hour telephonic journey was fairly impressive. There was diversity, and the people were personable. But in the end, it left me fearful and empty in a sort of Orwellian way. I'd spoken to four people from around the world, but still had the same question. Can somebody help me, please? Quantity, even global quantity, doesn't equate to quality. I'm William Morse, and this is The Last Minute.
Thanks for joining us for Interchange. Your thoughts and comments are welcome. Drop us a line at interchange@wfhb.org. That's interchange@wfhb.org. Thanks to Shane Young for engineering tonight's show. Interchange is produced by Allison Bechtesh, Ryan Dawes, and William Waters. The executive producer is January Jones. Theme music is by Jamil Effiam and Korea Clark and White. My name is Ashley Beeman, and thanks for listening. Stay tuned now for Stardust with Tillman, right here on your community radio station, WFHB.
Real people.
Real issues.
This is your forum.
This is Interchange.
Written and produced entirely by volunteers working in the studios of Community Radio WFHB in Bloomington, Indiana.
Interchange fosters unfiltered open dialogue on the people, issues, and events impacting life in South Central Indiana and beyond.
Comments, suggestions, and program ideas may be sent directly to the Interchange staff.
The email address is news@wfhb.org.
That address once again is news@wfhb.org.